All right, so chapter 5. Okay, so really this next section, this interaction between the Philistines and the ark, ranges from chapter 5 into the beginning of chapter 7. And this is just awesome, right? These chapters are just so great. But really, kind of the point here, we continue to see this public demonstration of God's centrality, and again, that he is the ultimate king, right? That's really what's being displayed, and specifically not just to Israel, but to the nations, okay, to the Philistines themselves as well. But before getting into the events of these chapters themselves, we just need to point out a couple things, right, that this chapter is going to address. So first off, with the defeat of Israel and the capture of the ark, like, you have to understand how the Philistines would have viewed this, okay? Because in those times, there is this inseparable link between a nation and its god or its gods, okay? And so this meant that when two nations were battling each other, they would view this as the gods of those nations are also battling each other, okay? And so then if whatever nation won meant that their god defeated the other god, that was kind of the mindset of the people back then. And so in the case of the Philistines, who were originally fearful of the God of Israel, what do they now assume? Like, our God just beat Israel's God. Like, this is awesome, right? We're looking pretty good. And so these chapters are going to address that, right? They're going to deal with that. The second thing that we need to understand is when the Philistines defeated Israel in this battle of Aphek, they really should have just then conquered kind of the whole nation. Okay, because you remember I said they do their divide and conquer type of thing. Really, nothing is stopping them from just kind of continuing the campaign, right? We'll see they kind of continued a little bit, but the question is, like, they just dealt a massive blow to Israel. What kind of happened? Why did they just stop, right? Why didn't they just continue on and take over more of Israel? And these chapters are going to show kind of a reason for that as well. All right, so just keep those in your mind as we go through this, okay? All right, so chapters 5 and 6, they focus on this interaction between the Philistines and the ark that they just captured. And so the first stop, they bring the ark to the city of Ashdod. Okay, the city of Ashdod. And do you remember what they first do with the ark? Where they put it? Yeah, the house of Dagon. That's their god. Okay, so they bring it into the temple of their god Dagon. Which is, I don't know, the god of Dagon is represented by like a half fish, half man person, if you're curious. It's kind of an interesting thing. But they put it in the temple and they place it next to their like Dagon, possibly like in front of Dagon, which would probably symbolize what? Why would they like place it like next to him or like maybe in front of their god Dagon? Yeah, he like possesses it, he owns it. Maybe even like he's bowing, like this god is now bowing down to their god, right? Kind of a thing. That's kind of what's going on. And so, but it's at least this ark, like the god of Israel is now under the control of Dagon. Okay, that's kind of what they're thinking. But then this is, again, such a great story, right? Because do you remember what happens the next morning? What do they find? Yeah, Dagon's tipped over face down in front of the ark, right? And so what's the symbol, what's Dagon essentially doing? Yeah, he's bowing down to the ark, right? He's bowing down to Yahweh, okay? And then it's just, I don't know, the crazy thing of idolatry and false gods, right? Because then what do? They're like, yeah, we need to like help our god back up. Like, whoa, like this isn't good, right? Let's prop him back up. Like, their god isn't even strong enough to stand up on his own, right? Like, let's help him up. He's kind of struggling here. So they get him back into place, and then what do they find the next morning? Yeah, face down again, but then what else? Yeah, like his head's cut off, his hands are cut off. Like, whoa, that isn't good. So not only face down, but then what's it showing? That Dagon is what? Dead, right? He's dead, okay? But then you can even ask the question, well, like, you could have shown that by just, like, the head being removed, right? Why also the hands? And that's probably because, well, like the hands are like, that's actually what you like do stuff with, okay? And so what this is showing is that Dagon is not only completely dead, he also has no power to do anything whatsoever, right? He is rendered incapable of doing anything. And so this is all putting Yahweh on display as the true God, okay? He is central not only in Israel, but everywhere. Okay, and he's declaring that even to the Philistines, right? So you can't miss that, right? He's showing, I am the true king, not only just in Israel, even in the land of Philistines, everywhere I am the true king, right? And your gods are going to like bow to me, right? Like this is, like you didn't win because your God defeated me, okay? This is all my plan, essentially. So that whole thing is awesome, okay? And then the Lord, it says, starts to actually inflict like a plague on the Philistines in Ashdod. And it's something like people speculate, almost kind of like a bubonic plague type of thing, right? And so the people obviously are not happy about that. They freak out. And so the rulers of the Philistines all gather and they decide, well, let's like move the ark, okay? Let's take it to like the city of Gath instead. And kind of wonder, like, well, why do they do that, okay? And they're probably thinking that, they're kind of wondering, like, well, maybe this God of Israel, this Yahweh, maybe isn't as strong in Gath as he is here, right? And I had, like, a professor equated almost like searching for, like, a phone signal, right? Like a phone connection, right? Where at certain points, your connection might be a little bit stronger in other places and weaker in other. And so they're probably thinking in the same way of like, well, maybe depending on where we put this ark, this Yahweh God, maybe he won't be quite as strong in another place. Or maybe Dagon will be a little bit stronger. We get a better signal from Dagon or something, right? Kind of a thing. But is that going to work? No, right? That's not going to work. And again, the point is going to show he's just as powerful everywhere, right? He's central. He is that true king. And so they take the ark to Gath. And the same thing happens, right? Like the people are afflicted with this plague. And then they send the ark to Ekron. They're like, get this out of here. It's like this game of hot potato happening. Like, we don't want it. You take it. And I love the response of the people in Ekron in verse 10. If you look at that in chapter 5 of what do they say when like they see the ark coming? And it says the people of Ekron cried out. They have brought, or was it? They brought around to us the ark of God of Israel to kill us and our people, right? Remember, this is the Philistines, like themselves, right? And so it's like this, they're all even like disunifying here because these people, as they see the ark coming, like, why would you do this? You're doing this to kill us. And it's just, again, showing this chaos and disunity that's all happening amongst the Philistines because of the ark, right? Because of God, right? He is the one at work here. And so this goes back to kind of that question of the Philistines were in this prime position to continue to conquer Israel and just take them over. And why didn't they? Because based on this passage, why probably they didn't continue their campaign is what? They're preoccupied with this, right? This whole situation of like, what is happening in our nation, right? And so they're probably having to halt their campaign in order to deal with this. And again, if you just think about that, right? Like, does Israel do anything with that? No, it's all God, right? It's all him fighting this battle in a sense, right? He's the one halting their progress. He's the one stopping this because again, by our human reasoning, like they should have just taken over at this point, right? Like they won that initial battle and it's like nothing stopping them until what? God intervenes. And he's creating all this chaos, this unity among the Philistines that they need to halt this, okay? So it's all happening in this regard. And again, addressing the other thing, did Dagon really defeat Yahweh? No, right? Like, and so all this is putting God on display as this true king overall, right? Not even just of Israel, but of all. And so it gets to the point, finally, of Philistines, like the people of the Philistines are like, just please return it, right? Like, just put the ark, give it back to Israel. We don't want it. This is bad. And so they decide to return it. Okay, so chapter 6 is kind of all about this, where they're returning the ark back to Israel. We see that it was in the land of the Philistines for 7 months, so extended period of time here. And they developed this plan to send the ark back. And it's interesting of just like with the limited knowledge they have, where like you see the Philistines, they offer some sort of guilt offering with this. Okay. And they do like this guilt offering of like these 5 golden tumors and 5 golden mice. I don't know how you make a tumor out of, I don't know what that looks like exactly, but they do it. And notice verse 5 though of chapter 6, when they do all these things, what's the last thing they say? And they need to give what? yeah, glory to the God of Israel, right? You can't miss that, right? That's just amazing, right? That they understand this. So not only do we need this, we need to give glory to the God of Israel, right? Like for all this to kind of stop. And so they develop this plan, right? So they have this offering and they put the ark and this offering into this cart. And then they're going to get like two milk cows who've never pulled anything to pull this cart back to the land of Israel, specifically Beth Shemesh there in Israel. But they also mention that they're going to take the calves of those cows and leave them like in the land of the Philistines. And now why would they do that? Why would they just strap the cows? And we're going to use these cows to pull the cart, but we're going to leave the calves back home. Yeah, exactly. They're not going to leave their calves, right? They're not going to leave their young. And so what are they trying to essentially show, like try to prove of like, is this actually like God, right? Like, is this actually a work of God or is this by chance, right? You see that even mentioned, what was that, verse 9? Yeah, verse 9, at the end of verse 9, they kind of ask this question of, hey, if this happened, like, was this by coincidence, right? And so they're trying to set it up to where like they need to know beyond the shadow of doubt that this is not just coincidence. This is the work of the God of Israel. And so they do all this and they get the two cows to pull the cart. And the text talks about how the cart just goes directly back to like Beth Shemesh, right? It says like it didn't turn to the left or right. It wasn't as if these cows were just meandering around and then just happened to land in Beth Shemesh. It was like, no, they're just on a path and we're going, right? Again, and it wasn't like someone was leading them. It's literally the cows are just pulling this cart, right? And so it is this clear demonstration like that this was the Lord's doing, right? And the Philistines understood it. They're like, because again, that's what they said, that in that verse 9, like they'll watch it and if it goes up on the way to its own land to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand that struck us. It happened to us by coincidence, right? That's what they're trying to prove. And that's exactly what they see is this. It happens exactly, goes to the land, goes to Beth Shemesh, and you have them like understanding like, okay, this was the God of Israel, right? Like this was a work of his hand, not by chance, not coincidence that we all just got this plague, right? But it's all the work of the God of Israel. It's the work of Yahweh. So we see God, again, showing this public display to the nations as well, that he is central. He is the true king. All right. And then you see the people of Beth Shemesh as they're working the fields. They see the ark coming, which I feel like that's got to be a sight, right? This just cart being pulled by cows, carrying the ark. Like, well, this is awesome, right? This is coming back to us. And they even offer some burnt offerings, and everything seems so good. But then what happens in verse 19? Yeah, see, the Lord struck down some of the people of Beth Shemesh. It's like, well, why did that happen? It says, because they looked upon the ark of the Lord. And probably the idea is they were trying to look inside the ark, right? So they're like, let me get a peek what's going on, right? And here and all that. And so they did not show proper reverence to the Lord, right? That's supposed to be, again, this representation of God's presence is dwelling with his people, and they're treating it without any reverence, okay? And so once again, you see the irony that the Philistines seem to show the Lord more reverence, especially with their like limited knowledge of all of this that they have than Israel does, with all the knowledge they have of who God is, how they're supposed to act. And so you see this contrast here. And this again shows another important issue in like our theology of kingship, which is what? You need to respect the king. Okay, like the capital K king, right? Not just the earthly king, like, but God is king. You need to respect him. He is the ultimate king and needs to be central to all. Okay. And so in light of that, the people of Beth Shemesh contact the people of Kiriath Jearim and say like, hey, please take the ark from us. And so the people from Kiriath Jearim do that, and it remained in about like 20 years pass. Okay, so we have this kind of gap here from that beginning of chapter 7 to what we come to next, because we have 20 years kind of pass here. But again, you can't miss in all that. God is the ultimate king. He is the one working. He is the one fighting for Israel and all of that. And then in the remainder of chapter 7, we see Samuel functioning as this judge. Okay, so he's not only this prophet, but he is a judge that has been raised up by God. And you see Samuel calling the people to repentance, to like, hey, put away all your foreign gods. And he says, like, instead, direct your hearts to the Lord and serve him alone. And so right away, you see he is much different than the other judges, right? Like, he is much different than the other judges that we're used to seeing. And the people actually listen, right? They actually listen. They put away their false gods. It says they serve the Lord only. So it's all, that's good, right? They're heading in a good direction. And then you have Samuel gathering the people at Mizpah. Okay, they have people gathering at Mizpah. And I should mention on a side note of kind of maybe some background here, because where would you probably expect Samuel to gather the people? Where has he been recently, like with the tabernacle and all that? Do you remember what city? Yeah, Shiloh. So he was in Shiloh. Like, well, why is he gathering in Mizpah? And what some people suggest is, like, the text doesn't clearly tell us, but maybe after the Battle of Aphek, that the Philistines actually did continue on a little bit in their campaign, and they attacked kind of the religious center of Israel, which is Shiloh. Okay, there's texts in the Old Testament that talk about the destruction of Shiloh due to the sin of the people and all that. And so some people suggest that that's what those passages are referring to, that it was destroyed there. And so the idea would be like Samuel understood what was coming and he moved the tabernacle before everything was like destroyed. Okay. And so they're gathering here at Mizpah now rather than in Shiloh. Okay. So that's like kind of a suggestion with that. But back to our account. So the Philistines hear of this meeting of Israel at Mizpah and they decide to go attack them again. Okay. So they want to attack again. And again, some people suggest a link to Samson actually being a cause here. And specifically, they suggest that this was in response to, remember, Samson in his death when he kind of just pushes the pillars, destroys the building, and he just like kills like a few thousand of the Philistines. And so people suggest that that's what prompted this attack now. And it could be like they're angry, right? Like this Israelite guy just killed a bunch of our people. But then also, who's now dead? Samson, right? And so it's like, hey, let's go attack, right? Like, they don't got this guy anymore. Let's go attack. And so it seems like an opportune time. And so they come, but then in verse 8, notice what the people of Israel do. What do they do in verse 8 there? Chapter 7. They ask Samuel to do something for them. Yeah, cry out to the Lord, right? They cry out to the Lord to deliver us. They actually turn to the Lord, right? And that's what we've been seeing all along. Like when they actually rely on him, trust in him, then what happens? Good things, right? They have success. And so Samuel offers sacrifice to the Lord, cries out to them. And then look at verse 10. It says that the Lord thundered with a mighty sound against the Philistines, which threw them into confusion, and he caused them to be defeated before Israel. So the Lord intervened and like helped his people, right? He delivered his people. And Israel was even able to regain some of the cities that the Philistines had had before, right? They actually pushed forward against the Philistines. And we can't miss the main point here, right? Who is the one who defeated Israel's enemies? It's God, right? God can overcome their enemies. He is the true king. And that's what this chapter, this section is really cementing for us. God is king, okay? And so that's what is being established in this section. Now let's see if we can get through chapter 8 here. All right, so then that takes us into the second section of Samuel, 1 Samuel here, where we see the institution of the monarchy, okay? And this is where primarily we're going to see like the establishment of Saul as king. And if you remember, if you're here last time for our introduction into Samuel, the purpose of this section, right, is to show you what a king should be like by giving you like the wrong king, right? Essentially, you see what not to do in order to learn what to do, okay? So Saul is like the bad example of he is this wrong king, and in the process, you're going to see what the true king, what the right king should be, because it's not like Saul, right? Like in different ways, okay? But chapter 8 is a very pivotal moment in Israel's history, okay? As we transition from the time of the judges into the monarchy. And so what ends up happening in this chapter, right? The beginning of the chapter talks about Samuel growing old. And then notice what he does. It says he made his sons judges over Israel. And now kind of stop for a moment. Is this how judges were supposed to work? No, like did Samuel have the right to make his son judges over Israel? No. Who was the one that was supposed to raise up judges? God was, right? And so Samuel, in kind of appointing his sons as these judges, he's kind of functioning more like a monarchy in a sense, right? Where it's like, oh, my sons will take over. It's fine, right? Like, but that's not how it was supposed to be. And we see this is not a good situation. His sons also were not good, okay? They did not walk in like the ways of Samuel and all that. And this ends up leading to Israel demanding something, right? What do they demand? A king. They demand a king. And don't miss, they also say like they demand king just like all the nations, right? Can't miss that last part, right? Because remember, they're supposed to be a light to the nations. They're supposed to be distinct from the nations to stand out. But instead, what? We want to be just like them, right? We want a king just like them. But what should have Israel known at this point, especially based on what we just established in the last section? Did they have a king? Yeah. Which was who? God, right? That was what was on clear display. Like, God is your king. And they just have witnessed all this and they say, no, we want a king like the nations. We want a human king. Okay? They should have trusted him. And you might be thinking though, like, wait a second, like we've been emphasizing all along, like especially like in Judges and stuff, that God has been setting up for a king, right? Judges even showed us like you need a king. And so what is wrong with the people asking for a king here, right? That's kind of a question. And the problem was not wanting a king, right? Because that was God's plan, but rather the issue was asking for a certain kind of king, okay? And more, and so they wanted a king of their own choosing, and just like all the other nations. And really, the issue becomes that Israel was a theocracy, right? God is their king. That's what it's supposed to be. But the heart of it is they want to change kind of the whole system. Okay, they want to change the whole system. They don't want a theocracy. They just want a monarchy. We just want a king. Like, for example, like, let's consider, like, the judges, right? Like, the judges were raised up and used by God as part of, like, his theocracy, right? Like, he is still king, but he's using these people. And so the people here, it isn't as if they just want kings to replace judges, right? It's like, well, instead of judges, just give us a king. That's not what they're saying, okay? They want to change the whole system to essentially, they don't want a theocracy. They don't even want a theocratic monarchy. They just want a monarchy like the other nations. And so what they're essentially saying to God is, give us a human king and you don't have to be king anymore. That's what they're saying. That's a big deal. It's almost like essentially like a coup, right? Like to overthrow God from Israel. And so now you can understand like why he tells Samuel in this chapter, what? Like, they haven't rejected you, they've rejected who? Yeah, me. They've rejected me as being king over them. Okay? That's why this is such a big deal. Okay, God's plan always led to a king, but it was a king of his choosing in his timing, and this isn't it. Right? This isn't it. And so the Lord tells Samuel to warn the people of kind of the implications of having a king, right? What that's going to mean on their families, their properties, their crops, all that stuff. And despite all the negative things that come along with that, do the people care? No. Like, look at verse 19. And it says that they refused to obey the voice of Samuel. And they said, no, but there shall be a king over us, right? Like, you see, they are obstinate on this. Like, we want a king, okay? But then also notice in verse 20 here, what is one of the main things they point to of what they want, like in a king, what they want a king to do for them? Yeah, they want a king that can go out for us and fight our battles. And what's the irony there? Yeah, God's been doing it all along. They just saw it. Like chapter 7, like God, they weren't doing anything, right? Like God defeated them, like the enemies for them. God's been fighting all these battles. And they're like, no, we want a king who can fight our battles. What? Like, it's just crazy, right? But I should also point out, like, again, in Deuteronomy 17, we've kind of talked about this before. That's like where you have kind of the laws concerning the kings. And that's where we have like our three G's, like the what kings should not multiply, right? The gold, gals, and Gideon, right? They don't multiply all those things. But also in that chapter, we see one of the primary jobs of the kings of Israel was supposed to write down the law. They were supposed to write their own copy of the law. And the idea would be that they would then be an enforcer of the law. That would be their primary focus as king, is to uphold the law, to enforce the law in the land of Israel. Like, of course they will fight battles. Yes, that's part of it. But that wasn't the main job of the king of Israel. The main job was to be this enforcer of the law, to uphold the law for the nation. And this further shows that they wanted a different kind of king than what God had planned. Right? They don't want the king that God wants. They want their own king. They want a king like the nations. That's what's happening here. That's why this is such a big deal. But God allows them to have this king. Okay, tells Samuel, like, hey, give him a king. But this kind of becomes a be careful what you ask for type of situation, or you get what you ask for. Because who do they initially get as king? Saul. And as we're going to see next time, like, he really is the type of king that people would want. But is that the king that they should actually want? No. And it's not going to go well, right? It's going to go bad. Because, again, they're focused on the wrong things, okay? And that's what we're going to see in the life of Saul, that he is not the right king. He is not the king that God would have in store. And that's going to lead us and point us towards the right king, which will be who? David, right? And eventually Christ at the end of all that, okay? All right, so that kind of wraps us up for tonight. That puts us at that place. And next week, not next week, we won't meet because of Easter, but the week after that, we'll pick up with Saul.